Seated.
We have two matters that involve Matthew Fugate. The first matter is case number 69925, Fugate versus State. Are you ready to proceed, Ms. Buckner?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
We'll take these cases separately, if you don't mind.
And Your Honor, if I could, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm here on behalf of Matt Fugate today to discuss the issues that arose during his district court jury trial on one count of lifetime supervision violation. The violation was charged as actually two counts. One was a telephone count, which the jury acquitted on. The other was having a minor in a secluded area, secluded environment. Now, the interesting thing about our statutes is that they do not define the term secluded environment.
Before you go forward with that, what was his status at the time of his arrest? Was he expired and just on lifetime supervision, or was he on parole?
He was on lifetime supervision only. So Mr. Fugate took Preston, one of the two, and he went out in his truck to go quadding. The parents of this 15-year-old knew where they were going and were supposed to ride with them, but weren't ready. So they got in the car in Sparks. It's about a 10 or 15-minute drive to USA Parkway exit, where there's a convenience market, where Mr. Fugate came out the wrong entrance of the convenience store. Nobody raised any questions as to whether that was PC for a stop or not. It was private property. Be that as it may, Mr. Fugate is stopped. The officer sees that he has a child with him. The child is 15. The officer runs him through the system. It's called a DONS system. And it comes back that he's a sex offender. Mr. Fugate makes a statement that he knows he shouldn't be with a child that age, but that the parents are coming right behind them. And in fact, the parents got there within 10, 15 minutes to pick up the child when the police officer took the child. So basically what happens is the question on the case becomes, was it a secluded environment? So Mr. Olson filed pretrial motions. He explained to the court, as did the officer who testified, this environment is a busy area. It's not what USA Parkway was 10, 15 years ago. USA Parkway is now a hub. Tesla's there. Walmart distribution center's there. Convenience market's there. People go there to fly airplanes, quad, ride dirt bikes, anything you can do in the desert. The officer testified on an average day, 7 to 10 people, always milling around there. And the child testified that they were meeting friends of his that were already at that location. So then the state argued, both at closing, that the truck itself could be a secluded environment and that that area was secluded. The court gave a jury instruction, which is number 23, which kind of basically made anything a secluded environment, because the court's jury instruction said it's a location where there's the opportunity to remove a child from view. So you could be sitting in a living room with a blanket, and that child could be removed from view, and you would be in a secluded environment. You would be guilty of this offense. So kind of what happens with the jury is they go out to have a jury question. Their jury question is, can you look at Exhibit 3, both 18 and 24B of that section? And the problem with those issues is that they conflict. 24B removed the language secluded environment and simply held Mr. Fugate to strict environment if he was with a child. So the jury had this question. The district court responded by saying, look at jury instruction number 7. Instruction number 7 says you look at everything that's been admitted in the court, and good luck.
Well, that was correct to what the district judge did in that particular case, to refer to that other jury instruction.
What's interesting is the conflict in the evidence, the rules on the lifetime supervision agreement, and the jury instruction. Because the jury instruction itself told them it had to be a secluded environment, and within the secluded environment, they gave the definition, which I object to.
But the jury didn't ask about the conflict itself, did they?
The jury's question, and I actually somewhere here have it, was specifically when we're evaluating this count, the secluded environment count, can we use Exhibits 19, can we use 18 and 24 from Exhibit number 3? And 18 and 24 conflict. Because 18 says you can't be with a minor in a secluded environment, and 24B says you can't be with a minor. So it's our position
that... Let me pause you for one moment. The only statutory place I see secluded environment is in 213.1245.1K.
Correct.
Which is describing parole conditions.
Correct.
Are you making any challenge that it was inappropriate to incorporate that as a condition of lifetime supervision and therefore under our McNeil decision the conviction cannot stand? I don't see that in the papers, but McNeil came down post-briefing and I...
Right, and it wasn't in the papers, and when McNeil came down I read it and reread it, and it's a great question is the answer. Because McNeil dealt with like the cell phone issue, where it's clearly not even mentioned.
That yes, it's nowhere in the
yeah,
chapter.
They just made it up and said you can't do it. So McNeil was more a case of if it's not in a statute somewhere, you can't apply it. But 213.1245 does provide that he shouldn't be with a minor in a secluded environment. Mm-hmm. But he's not charged with that. The charging document charges only the lifetime supervision violation and doesn't refer to the statute itself.
Right, but the lifetime supervision agreement incorporates language from 1245.
It did, and then it incorporated...
Or not agreement, but the document.
Yeah, from the statute.
Yeah.
So, actually, and that is true. Section number 18 on Exhibit 3 is a quote from the statute, but section number 24 takes it one step further. And so you do get into a McNeil issue because it's any child in any location. And that wasn't what the statute said. So the jury was conflicted, and I think that's one of the reasons that they asked jury question number 2. And the response from the court wasn't, you must find the secluded environment. It was, you can look at all of the exhibits. And unfortunately, exhibit number 3 has a conflict in it. So that's probably the key issue on the case, is whether the failure to have that language in Exhibit 3 in both spots reduced the state's burden of proof on a critical element, and that is that it's a secluded environment. And what exactly a secluded environment is in the state of Nevada. When you have testimony that there's 7 to 10 people there, there's a police officer out writing tickets, there's parents are on the way, and the parents knew, and you know, I don't know how much they knew. Apparently their testimony was that they knew he had a parole officer. So that's the basis of that. The other question on this case is a sentencing question. And as I'm sure you noted, Judge Sattler did the sentencing on both of the cases combined. The procedure that he used was to allow Mr. Olson to argue both cases, each DA argued separately. Now, when the case was done and he had imposed the two 20-year terms on the other case, he imposed the 19 to 48 recommended by parole and probation on this case. And then it ended, except it didn't end, because he said, Deputy, you need to bring Mr. Fugate back in here. I misspoke. And so he brought the defendant back in after issuing the 19 to 48 months and said, it was always my intention to give you the maximum, 28 to 72, and I misspoke, and therefore I'm changing this. And so it's our position that that was an abuse of discretion because he had finished sentencing, imposed 19 to 48, sent the defendant out, and changed his mind. And brought him back to give him the maximum. And so we would put forth that that is an abuse of discretion.
What about the presenting evidence concerning the prior judgment of conviction and appellant's prison sentence in the prior conviction? What about that issue?
That causes a lot of heartburn and grief. In an ex-felon in a firearm setting, we know very clearly the defense walks in and stipulates to the ex-felony and it's done. The jury just gets an instruction that says he's been convicted of a felony. In this particular case, the jury was not only provided with exactly what the charge was, they were provided with the fact that he went to prison because the judgment of conviction was admitted. Now, I suppose, as I read Mr. McCarthy's brief, his view is that might be an ineffective assistance of counsel issue and it's not properly before the court. But from our persuasion, it's in front of the court because it's a judgment of conviction admitted as Exhibit 5, admitted by the district court, and given to the jury. When in fact, all they had to tell the jury was he has been convicted of a sexual
assault. The trial attorney didn't do that.
Didn't do that.
So there was no objection to that conviction coming in?
No. And frankly, had it been read, it would have told defense counsel that it says not only was he convicted, but that he went to prison. So the jury knows it was a serious enough offense to to land him in prison for 10 years because the judgment tells him how long he went to prison.
What about the defendant's silence on that issue?
This is an interesting case on the prosecutor's comments. And Mr. McCarthy thought that they really related more to simply the telephone, but they didn't. Because what the state says is that he didn't tell his parole officer, I wasn't in a secluded environment. But what he did was not speak. He can have that right to not speak. You don't have to tell the police what your defense is or your parole officer what your defense is. So at trial, the state argued that Mr. Fugate was not denying it. That's a comment on his silence. Mr. Olson objected. The court admonished the jury to disregard the comment, admonished Mr. Steggy to stay within the bounds of argument. But then he continued, because the state argued that Mr. Fugate's mouth must have been glued shut, and he was the most unlucky sex offender in Washoe County. And those comments are definitely on the fact that he chose not to speak.
Can I ask you specifically, maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but after the first day of trial, the district court met with the parties to discuss exhibits, and the state offered a copy of the 2003 judgment of conviction. And my impression, or what's indicated to me, is that the defendant indicated he would not object to its admission.
Correct. And that is why I said Mr. McCarthy's position would be that that's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. My position is that it's plain error to tell this jury that this man went to prison on a prior offense for this type of an offense.
If this is a charge of violation of lifetime supervision based upon a sex offense, why, it's relevant, isn't it?
Well, I think it's relevant because the state has to prove that element. But they only have to prove he was convicted of a sex offense. They don't have to prove that he went to prison. And that exhibit told the jury all the guts of the case, instead of just telling them he was convicted. It wasn't redacted. And the district court should be making sure that we're not giving jurors inflammatory, prejudicial information by way of this type of exhibit.
You're equating it with the practice that we do in the criminal defense bar with ex-felon in possession of a firearm.
Exactly.
Sever it from the other counts and then just stipulate to that. And the counsel didn't do that.
Except that you're agreeing that the jury can be told that he's a convicted sex offender to make sense of the predicate conviction.
Absolutely.
It's the going to prison piece of it that you're objecting to. Absolutely.
I think normally in this type of a trial, what you would have seen is the defense would have said, we stipulate to the prior conviction, and there would have been a stipulation entered in a jury instruction that says the defendant stipulates he has been convicted as a sex offender.
You have about 2 minutes and 30 seconds left.
I'm going to save that. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. McCarthy, on behalf of the state.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County on behalf of the state, and that stipulation didn't happen. And because it didn't happen, the prosecutor had no choice but to prove the elements of the offense. The elements included a prior conviction. The best evidence of a prior conviction, short of a stipulation, is a certified copy of a judgment of conviction. There's nothing wrong with that. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that it was ineffective assistance at all. If we get to that eventually, I'll deal with it then. But I'm not suggesting it was ineffective. I'm suggesting it was a tactic to put the state to its burden of proof. There's simply nothing wrong with it. You know, the secluded environment, it doesn't seem to be a McNeil type issue. It's not raised here. It's just whether there's a constitutional violation, whether that...
Before you go to the vagueness and so on, could you walk me through why you don't... I get that it's not raised, but I puzzled over the McNeil issue a bit preparing for today's argument, and I'd like to hear your take on it.
It seems, as I read McNeil, it's a limitation on the parole board. They can't just go make them up whole cloth. Well, they didn't. It's already in the statute. I would think that the parole board, as they set the conditions, either a parole or a lifetime supervision, should be able to draw from what the legislature
But a parole violation sends you back on your already existing conviction and sentence, correct?
Yes.
McNeil is a new crime under the last paragraph of 1243. if you violate a condition of lifetime supervision. So to the extent you're putting into a lifetime supervision document the predicate for a new crime if you violate it, is there an argument that McNeil should apply, even though I'll grant you this does have a statutory origin, it's just in the parole setting. Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do. And to the question of could it be argued? Absolutely. I haven't seen anything I can't argue.
Yeah, so. Okay. But it's not present in this case because it wasn't raised.
And because McNeil would seem to allow it anyway. Just because there's a statutory basis. I read McNeil as dealing more with the powers of the parole board, not to just make up conditions out of whole cloth. So as long as there's a statute.
Even though the violation becomes a new crime.
Right.
Not just you go back to prison. I recognize to a person involved it's six of one, half dozen of another, but legally to me, to have an agency making up a new crime is a little different than violating parole.
I understand. Well, although we have told prisoners in the past through this court that one of the reasons they can't object to the conditions of lifetime supervision ahead of time is because we don't know what they are, because the parole board hasn't determined them. So that would seem to indicate there is at least some authority, although you can't make it up out of nothing.
Okay, fair enough.
Mr. McCarthy, my question to McNeil is, this sentencing hearing was February 4, 2016, I believe in the transcript. McNeil came down after that, didn't it? I mean, the fact that McNeil's a relatively recent case, does that have any bearing in your analysis?
I must admit, I haven't thought about retroactivity. It doesn't seem to be one of those that puts primary conduct beyond the reach of the criminal law, and so I suspect that perhaps McNeil should be prospective only. But I haven't looked into it because it hasn't been raised.
Okay, thank you.
This court has from time to time ordered additional briefing. I'm not asking for that because I'm lazy. But it has happened. Okay. So on the subject of vagueness, I suggested it's not vague. Any statute can be more precise, and we get the debate here focuses on what we mean by environment, and I suggest the environment is the truck, and the truck in which an interested or disinterested person cannot tell that this child is in the truck until he walks up alongside and gets the attention of the driver. I suppose at one extreme, we would have a Mazda Miata convertible with the top down on Las Vegas Boulevard at midday. Probably not very secluded. On the other is a semi-tractor trailer with the little bedroom in the back, and that almost certainly is secluded. I think that this is closer to the latter than the former, and that it is precise enough to allow this defendant, a person of reasonable intelligence, to know, and in fact he did know, as indicated by his own comments, to, I believe his PO, that...
So you're indicating it's not necessarily where it occurred as far as being a secluded environment.
I don't think
it's... being a 7-Eleven, approximately 15 miles north of Sparks. Trying to picture.
That road changes over time. It's not geographic. I think if the legislature had defined it in geographic terms, then it could have said, I don't know, more than 3 miles from the nearest gas station. I don't know what they could have done. But it's not in geographic terms. It's in terms of society, what is secluded, what is creating the opportunity to do wrong. And that's how it was defined, and it was close enough. It's definite enough that this person knew that he shouldn't be doing that. I think what he said to his PO was, I forgot who I am. Now that sounds like he knew this was a secluded environment. So it, given the standards by which we judge unconstituted or vague statutes, I would say that this one passes muster in that it could be more clear, but it was clear enough for this defendant, clear enough for the person of average intelligence and state.
If we don't find it vague, if we don't find constitutional issues here, certainly it's a jury question as to whether it was a secluded environment, and the jury did find it a secluded environment.
Absolutely. And the instructions did nothing to, and the question from the jury did nothing to change that. I think that how secluded, that's not something that can be measured. It's secluded enough to give the opportunity. And so with the instructions, I think that we did just that. And so the statute and the instructions should be seen as appropriate.
Do you think the age of the youth comes into effect, like if this was like a 5-year-old as opposed to a 15-year-old? Do you think that has an effect on this at all as far as vagueness?
As I recall, the condition said minor child, which would seem to be up to 17, you know, a day under 18. I think the age would certainly affect sentencing, with any judge that I know, anyway. But, I don't think it would. This defendant at sentencing at one point tried to make a distinction based on the age. He said, well, you know, they weren't 9, he was 12. So what? You're not supposed to be there. Let's see, sentencing. Here we go. It seems to be an argument to give effect to the oral pronouncement of sentence, and this court has never done that. The judgment, the actual sentence is the written judgment, and this court has never wavered from that, and the court can change its mind and correct it any time until the judgment is signed by the court and entered by the clerk. And it's been well established for quite a few decades, and so we shouldn't mess with that.
What about the silence? The comment on the silence.
He wasn't silent. He spoke, and he spoke to his PO and said, I shouldn't have been there. He was silent about the other charge, the telephone charge, and the claim that he had had permission. But the guy's acquitted of that. As to the claim, the charge of being in a secluded environment with a minor, he spoke. There was no comment on silence because he wasn't silent. So that, look at that. I still got 5 minutes. I'm done talking here already.
Okay.
No questions. I'll sit down.
Any questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Carter. Ms. Becko, you've got a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The charging document in this case basically asks and says that on or about October 21st, 2012, in Washoe County or Story County, Mr. Fugate, after having been convicted, did have contact with a person less than 18 years of age, a male juvenile, in a secluded environment without another adult who has never been convicted of an offense present. It doesn't say they're talking about the truck. It doesn't say they're talking about his house, his garage, or USA Parkway. So there's a problem. The jury question, I think, the second jury question is worth looking at again quickly. They say, with regards to instruction number 19, element 3, that's the secluded environment instruction, are we able to consider all parts of evidence, document exhibit number 3, specifically number 18 and number 24, sub B? Are we allowed to consider both? 18 says, with a minor in a secluded environment. 24B says with a minor, anywhere, without an adult. Huge change. As far as McNeil, it does apply. This is a direct appeal, not a post-conviction appeal, and all of the law of Nevada goes all the way to the point you drop your hammer on your decision. So McNeil applies. The question is how it would apply. So basically, we don't know. Mr. McCarthy said the jury found in a secluded environment. We don't know if they found that he was with a minor, period, that's enough, or he found the secluded area because of their jury question number 2 and exhibit 3, 24B, which tells him just a child. As far as the case itself going to trial, and these weren't raised on both charges, of course, brought in a lot of evidence with one count that wouldn't have gone with the other count. Since there was no joinder and there was no severance motion, we can't really talk about that here. But the reality is that every minute he was fighting the statements he made, he was not talking to his parole officers. He did not speak to them, and the state commented negatively upon his choice to be quiet. That's all.
Thank you for your arguments in this matter.